Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is June 28th, 2018, and this is episode 92. Politicoast is the BC Politics Podcast. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you found us. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott Blainboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the Dirty Money Report, and we're going to be checking in on a bunch of electoral reform referendum updates as those slowly trickle through. First, though, as always, we're thanking our premier sponsors, Lindsay Tedds and Blake Hodson, for helping make the show possible. And we're reminding you to check out BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free 2-week trial, get that unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free 2-week trial, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. First up, damn dirty dollars. I had the chance this afternoon to speak to one attorney general and past guest of Politicoast, more famously for, David Eby. We wanted to talk to him after this big report came out yesterday called the Dirty Money Report, which looked at money laundering in BC casinos. It's by Dr. Peter German, who's a past RCMP officer and someone who's an expert on money laundering. And it's pretty damning. So let's just put it over to that interview and then we can get your thoughts on it. David Eby, welcome back to the podcast. You released this report by Peter German yesterday on dirty money in politics. It goes through a lot of incredible examples of how money is being laundered in BC casinos. Which of these was the most shocking to you, though?
Well, what's really the most shocking to me is that the government knew about this as early as 2011, and yet nobody said, to borrow a phrase from Dr. German's report, nobody said no. There wasn't a direction issued to casinos, as we issued in our first few months of our mandate, to stop accepting this cash unless the person bringing it in could prove where it came from, that it came from a legitimate source. So when you when your listeners watch the videos, which are freely available online, of people emptying reusable shopping bags of elastic bundled $20 bills onto the counter, and then realize that that footage actually is from 2012, that this has been happening for more than 5 years, for the better part of a decade, and that more than $100 million came through BC casinos in this way, they'll understand how strange it is and how scandalous, in my opinion, it is that government never said stop accepting this money unless people can prove where it came from.
So what needs to be done from here? What needs to be done to crack down on this?
Well, there were two reasons for me to ask Dr. German to take on this report. The first was to help British Columbians really understand what kind of briefing I had when I became minister responsible for this file, how my eyes were opened about the absolutely ridiculous things that were happening in BC casinos. And I think now British Columbians understand a little bit better about what I saw and what I was briefed on. So I'm grateful for that. And the second piece to answer your question is Dr. German set out a roadmap for us, a list of more than 40 recommendations. I've already directed that a fifth of them be implemented. They can be implemented right away through policy. The remainder, there are many recommendations that require significant legislative change. So in the fall, we'll be introducing new laws to deal with this. And in addition, I'll be working with my colleague, the Minister of Finance, the Minister of Public Safety, on a cross-ministerial team to implement complicated recommendations like establishing a dedicated policing presence in casinos and a dedicated regulator outside of government.
So there's no chance of a summer session to kind of get this through in an emergency sitting?
No. We're planning now for the fall. The immediate recommendations have been implemented. And I can tell your listeners, though, who might be concerned that the money is still coming through, that on the last report I had, at the peak, the money traveling through BC casinos, the suspicious cash transactions, was $20 million in a single month. That was July of 2015. The last month that I had data for, it was $200,000. So we've reduced it by a factor of 100 times, simply by imposing that one rule that was an early recommendation of Dr. German's: don't accept the money unless you know where it came from.
One of the things the report talks about is this infighting between the BC Lottery Commission and the Gaming Policy and Enforcement Branch, and how that may have contributed. Are you looking at steps, or have you taken steps to help improve interagency cooperation?
Yes. So the big recommendation from Dr. German on this is that the BC Lottery Corporation no longer be responsible for oversight of anti-money laundering policy and reporting and so on, and that it all be handed off to the oversight of the regulator, and for the casinos to no longer provide reports through the BC Lottery Corporation, but instead to send them directly into the federal agency that collects this information. And those are very sound recommendations. It's quite straightforward to understand how it might be that an agency that is charged, in this case, BC Lottery Corporation, that's charged with both increasing revenue from gambling and also responsible for ensuring regulatory oversight is maintained, might find itself in a difficult conflict of interest. You want to increase the money coming in, but you're also charged with keeping dirty money out. And this is a conflict of interest that has happened again and again in the gambling industry. It's not unique to BC, and it's just a peculiarity that we have a structure here where that structure is maintained. When Dr. German looked at Ontario and Nevada, they have separated those functions. They don't have their regulator charged with increasing revenue for obvious reason. The regulator's job is to make sure that the law and policy is followed, regardless of what the impact is on revenue. And the obligation of the service provider, or BC Lottery Corporation, is to increase revenue within the rules and under the oversight of the regulator. So I think it's a very sound recommendation. In the meantime, certainly there's no question now between the Gaming Policy Enforcement Branch and BCLC that we have a very serious problem on our hands, and everybody needs to work together and cooperatively. And I've had nothing but cooperation from both shops in terms of both the recommendations and the day-to-day obligations that we have to ensure the law is followed.
That conflict of interest you mentioned raises a sort of broader question about the economic impacts of this. I think the report talks about the $1 billion that comes into the BC economy because of casinos and gambling. How do you make sure in a way that, you know, you don't crack down so hard that we destroy a fundamental part of our economy?
You know, there's a really significant argument and an important argument to be made that regardless of the financial impact on the province, that we should not be accepting the proceeds of crime, organized crime, through our casinos and through gambling-related activities. And the reason for that is the costs associated with those kinds of illegal activities far exceed whatever revenue you would make from it. So, for example, Dr. German linked this activity in the casinos with fentanyl dealing, for example. And so the province will be spending hundreds of millions of dollars to deal with overdoses, to expand the capacity of the coroner, to deal with all the bodies that are, all the deaths that are arising from this horrific plague that we're facing, that is spawned by, it's funded by, and run by organized crime that's dealing with fentanyl in the first place. So while we may have made some money from the proceeds of those drug sales, the public expenditure far exceeded it. And specifically in terms of our budget, the finance minister, based on information collected by the BC Lottery Corporation, built in $30 million less in gaming revenue than was projected based on the understanding that we will likely see lower activity at these high roller tables where people are bringing these bags full of cash to gamble at the high roller tables in lower mainland casinos. BCLC did the best they could to project what the impact of a crackdown would be to make sure it was built into the budget so that we were ready for it as best as possible.
Outside of gambling and the casinos, there's been, and I think Dr. German mentions this, the impact on other aspects of the economy, like the third of our economy, of our GDP, that's apparently in real estate, and that, you know, this report is just scratching the surface, as it were, on the illicit activity going on in this province. You've talked already, I think, about launching a similar report into the real estate sector. What's the timeline for that? What other sectors are going to be looked at, and what kind of quick actions are you going to be taking?
So Dr. German was asked in his initial terms of reference to look at other areas of our economy that might be affected by money laundering. And in his review, he identified connections to three areas that he is encouraging government to have a careful look at. The first, as you mentioned, is real estate. Second is luxury cars, especially in the resale market. And the third is horse racing. And so his recommendations there certainly carry a lot of weight with us. And in particular, and just as a specific example of why, for example, on the real estate side, he's flagged that a lot of the individuals who are walking this these boxes and bags of cash into the casinos listed their occupation as being real estate related. So if this is the money that they're bringing into the market, into the casino for fun, where is the money coming from that that they're using for their business, for the real estate side coming from, and where is it ending up? And how much more significant is that money than even the more than $100 million that Dr. German identified that went into the casinos? So that's why you raise a red flag there. We've also seen reports from people like Sam Cooper and Kathy Tomlinson about how things like builder's liens are used by people, also alleged to be closely associated to what have been happening in the casinos and to organized crime. The building liens are where debt is registered against a property, usually by a builder, but allegedly in coverage by Kathy Tomlinson, the Globe and Mail, individuals who may have made cash loans to the homeowner and the cash coming from the proceeds of organized crime, and then they have a builder's lien registered against the home. And so the money is effectively laundered by them. So these are serious issues, and I'm working with my colleague, the finance minister, on the design and the timing of the second phase to deal with this issue.
The peak was in 2015, as you mentioned, and it started to taper off there, which suggests something changed. Perhaps the previous government was starting to take some actions. And this, I think, was in Jazz Johal's response to the report that they were working behind the scenes. And perhaps by going so publicly, it may have impeded the ability of prosecution of specific people. Why go for this public report and not, say, target the specific individuals and actors and do things more behind the scenes?
So, I heard Mr. Johal's comments, and obviously I'm concerned that if it is true that he believes that the previous government was told by law enforcement not to address the money laundering issue, not to talk about it, and to pretend it wasn't an issue, because the first report government had about this taking place was in 2011, and that means 6 years of law enforcement saying not to talk about this. And at some point, really, you do need to do something about the problem. With respect to compromising prosecutions, actually, we worked very closely with the RCMP and with other police forces to ensure that we weren't releasing anything that would compromise an investigation. There are two active law enforcement investigations underway right now. And we were fully cognizant of the risk of compromising those investigations. But as far as Mr. Johal's allegation that things were tapering off or slowing down because of action they'd taken, there were still $3 to $5 million a month in these suspicious cash transactions coming into these Lower Mainland casinos. And the video that we released of people from 2012, of people coming into the casinos and dumping their bags on the counter, those transactions are $200,000 to $500,000 in a single transaction. So if he was proud of a record where there were suspicious cash transactions on the order of $2 to $5 million a month coming through BC casinos, I figure that we've reduced to $200,000. And it really does speak to the difference between our philosophical approaches and the idea of what it looks like when things are under control in a casino, and what it looks like when casinos are being used as a laundromat for organized crime.
All right, my last question is just a quick one, but it's not related directly to this report. There was a Reddit thread in r/Vancouver that was the David Eby appreciation thread. Did you see this, and did you have any response to the admiration that was being shown there?
I did see it, and I am incredibly appreciative of Reddit's own unique way of expressing appreciation. I'm grateful for any support I get from British Columbians online and off, even if it's expressed in a very unique Reddit way.
All right. Anything else you want to add on the report?
No, that's it. Thanks very much, Ian.
All right. No problem. Thank you for taking the time.
Bye-bye.
So aside from right off the bat where Eby lines it up as a partisan, this was all the BC Liberals' fault, I think I was impressed to see that there are actually a lot of changes happening very quickly. And it's good to see that regulatory changes that can be made quickly are being done fast. Although I do wonder about like the scale of this challenge versus how much action can they take without a summer sitting. And I'm not saying they should try to rush legislation through, but it's also a, like, I think the report actually talks about if you don't close all of the holes, you know, it's a waterbed where it just moves around.
Yeah, the report talks quite a bit about how money laundering follows the path of least resistance. But nevertheless, there's still a lot you can do with some regulations around, you know, casinos and what they can do with regards to accepting cash transactions and stuff like that. So there's a lot of things they can plug immediately. But yeah, as you said, there's obviously a bunch of legislative changes that are going to be needed, such as changing who's responsible for what and creating the dedicated policing force, which was one of the recommendations in the report.
Yeah, some of the things they talked about are things I think we even used to have as a province, this investigative crimes unit. And I guess that's where the BC Liberals do have to wear some of this. And it was the common refrain of the BC NDP for the first year of their government to talk about the 16 years of BC Liberal inaction or whatever. But I think in this case, like, the report talks about how 2015 was this high watermark of corruption and money laundering, but then things did start to cool down a little bit. Now, the economy didn't change that much between 2015 and 2017, so it suggests to me some minor steps were being taken.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
But now the Liberals are kind of MIA on this file, as they've trotted out Jazz Johal, who wasn't in government at the time as their front person on this, despite the fact Rich Coleman is still hanging around and could, you know, face some questions about this.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's a deliberate choice on their part. And yeah, it's been interesting to see how Rich Coleman started the week off being rumored to be running for the mayor of Surrey and has since disappeared from public light.
Maybe he's taking an early Canada Day weekend, sort of gone off to the Kootenays for a nice little vacation or something like that. But besides his ghosting, it's hard for me to really find any of their criticisms to be landing. I think there is this public appetite for something more. And I've heard EB say in other interviews that, you know, he didn't go after specific people or get this report to name names and shame, because to do that, you have to be a lot more thorough and, you know, spend more time building the case, lest you face more libel lawsuits as a government. So he wanted to get something out that was well done and got it out quick so they could take action. And here we are. I think the question beyond the actions that are recommended in there, which seem mostly uncontroversial and low-hanging fruit to go after, is, you know, the wider implication of all of this money laundering in BC. Like, the report hints at real estate and luxury automobiles and horse racing. And there are calls starting to form around this idea of getting a public inquiry on, and Research Co. polled on this and found everyone likes the idea of a public inquiry. And I couldn't tell from that poll if it's just when you say, should we have an inquiry into bad things? And people are like, yes, bad things should be investigated.
Yeah, I'm really curious on what's the baseline for that. If a pollster just made up a scandal and polled people on whether or not there should be a public inquiry on that, I'm guessing you'd probably get something in the 70s, just as a minimum.
Mario at least asked on a specific policy idea of, say, banning bets of more than $10,000, which, man, I wish I had $10,000 to just bet on black at River Rock. But 68% of people are in favor of that, probably because 68% of people are like me and don't have $10,000 to drop on black. But I think the bigger problem is public inquiries don't always do much. Like, some of them have led to some serious changes, but I feel like there have been enough examples of big reports getting shelved that I'd almost rather just take the German report here, hit the low-hanging fruit, build off it to go into some of the other realms we've talked about, and just clean up the province a bit.
Yeah, the government seems intent on acting on this one, so you kind of already got the political will there. And, well, public inquiry, yeah, it's not a bad idea. It might just be better overall to get going on the actions right now, and, you know, rather than waiting a couple of years for an inquiry to collect evidence and everything. It's something that's definitely worth thinking about, but in terms of immediate action, I think what the BC government's doing is more or less right.
It's almost like a gold-plated, like, it's a terrible situation, but for a government to just kind of walk in and get this mess that has, it's not like it's easy to clean up, but the steps aren't difficult. Like, they're going to be popular if you come in and make the clear case that, look at how corrupt everything in this province is.
Yeah,
like, it's a political win. It's an easy
political
win. Especially
like this, where nobody's arguing the other side. There is no pro-money laundering faction out there.
Well, and that's what I tried to push back with on the question about, what about the effect of the economy? Because, like, if a third of our GDP is real estate, which is absurd, and we get $1 billion per year in gambling revenue, which is also a significant chunk of change, we could put the province's economy at risk just by tamping down on organized crime, because apparently BC is part of a like crime syndicate.
Yeah, although I think it's worth putting things into perspective here in that the $100 million, that was the number that everybody focused on and really grabbed a hold of. And it's a little on the conservative side. Peter German had said as much. And like, if you actually probably add up every number that appears in that report, it probably ends up at over $100 million. But that was over what, a 10-year period, I think is what was said. And real estate has $40 billion in transactions per year in the Lower Mainland. It's something. It's $100 million more than there should be at all, but it doesn't seem to be at the scale where it really tips things in one way or the other.
And of course, there's also, like EB pointed out, the human cost of people who are dying from the correlated fentanyl crisis and just the affordability crisis in housing. So, and the moral argument that it's wrong to fund your province off the proceeds of crime.
Yeah, this is something we should be doing whether or not it hurts the province's bottom line.
So yeah, they get to ride a wave of goodwill on this because, like you said, no one's for organized crime publicly.
Moving on to segment two, the pieces are in place. We got a little bit more information about how the proportional representation referendum is going to run. This week, the rules were announced by Elections BC on how the referendum was going to be funded. Each side has to basically form a society and have a single organization running the pro and con side. And that has to get approved by Elections BC. And then sometime after July 6th, they'll be formally selected and off to the races.
Yeah, the date, I think, is the most interesting thing in here. We knew there'd have to be societies from months ago, and these societies formed months ago. We talked about when Bill Thielman and Suzanne Anton founded the No BC PR Society, and what a great name that was, only to be matched by the Yes PR BC Society.
Not exactly winning for originality here.
So the societies had formed with academics and activists and politicians on both sides. And it would be shocking if the Thielman Club or the Dave Moskrop and Friends Club didn't get their respective approvals from Elections BC. Like if for some reason they just chose like some guy from, I don't know, Agassiz to run one of the main campaigns. The rules around what the society have to be are fairly straightforward, just like majority or two-thirds even potentially BC residents, nothing controversial. But like I said, the campaign is officially starting on July 1st, but they have till July 6th to submit their names, after which Elections BC will try as fast as it can to pick one on each side.
Yeah, that leaves a really interesting gap of nearly a week between when the campaign starts and when the parties actually get the go-ahead to start campaigning.
And that's been criticized, like everything else with this referendum. Like, realistically, it's basically just a reality of the timeline that Elections BC can't expect people to get paperwork done by tomorrow so that they could announce it, I don't know, Saturday?
Like, I don't think Elections BC works weekends normally.
Especially a long weekend. So it was always going to be, at this point, a little bit later. Well, I guess perhaps if the Attorney's General Office had ironically gotten this report out sooner, but apparently he was busy with some other things too. Poor guy.
He's only handling like every significant file in the province right now.
You gotta keep your potential premiers busy. So there's not a lot of meat here to criticize. I think the date is frustrating and it means a week without, you know, official organized campaigns, but by mid-July we'll have them announced and they'll have their money flowing from the province to start campaigning actively. In the meantime, though, the campaign is clearly on as people are running around the province talking for and against the idea of changing the system.
Yes, including a former premier, in fact.
Yeah, Ujjal Dosanjh, the last NDP premier before John Horgan, was in Victoria this morning beside Bill Thielman talking about how if we go to proportional representation, it'll allow in extremist parties and, you know, this system we have is pretty fair and has worked out pretty well so far.
Well, it worked out well for Ujjal Dosanjh.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like First Past the Post worked out great for Ujjal. Under his election campaign, he got some around 20-25% of the vote and two seats. which is not 20 to 25% of the legislature. But that's okay, because you don't want a Nazi party that gets 10% of the vote getting 10% of the seats, because democracy shouldn't do that, I guess. I think the other interesting thing is he was in government when the BC-NDP won in 96 with fewer votes than the BC Liberals, but did get more seats.
Yeah, and I think that's an experience that many people from the NDP from that era remember, and that might be motivating Bill Thielman as well. And it kicked off the Liberals' brief foray into wanting to change the system, which they lost two referendums on. But, you know, there's at least the Liberals for a time were in favor of it. But I guess the memories have faded far enough that they've decided, no, this is something terrible that must be fought.
Actually, you know what it is? Ujjal's now a Liberal.
He's a federal Liberal.
Federal Liberal, yeah. I don't think he's held a provincial party membership since the party burned his, because that's what the NDP does. The other person who's been running around the province is former New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark, a former Labour Prime Minister, I believe. She served a long time in the New Zealand legislature, so she actually was there when they were under First Past the Post, and I think she was actually against changing, and then they switched to mixed member proportional, and she learned to love it, it turned out. So she's been talking more about how New Zealand could be a good example for British Columbia, because they have a similar kind of population distribution, and they had a first past the post system, and the sky didn't fall. They're actually, I think, the only English-speaking Commonwealth jurisdiction that's really changed, at least in her claim, I think, from first past the post.
Doesn't the Australian Senate run on STV?
It does. So that's why I was kind of confused. And I know Scotland also uses STV. So maybe her claim's not like perfect. But she pointed out a number of things in a couple of the interviews that I've listened to her. Things like when New Zealand moved to MMP, they had a significant, I think like 10 to 20% jump in the number of female MPs elected. They got more Maori MPs, the local indigenous people. And just generally, she's found the legislature to be far more cooperative, because no party tends to hold a majority. So she says prior to this, it was always enclaves of talking to your own party and scheming how to bring down the other parties or whatever. But then after, the factual reality meant you actually had to try to build coalitions to vote on anything, and people would talk to each other about policy, which sounds like the dream. Oh, but not everyone is as impressed as Helen Clark with proportional representation. The Independent Contractors and Businesses Association of BC released a video against proportional representation, warning how it will fracture the province and the usual things. We're just going to hear the same damn arguments for like 6 months now, aren't we?
Oh, yeah.
I found this one amusing, because when you look up the BC returns for 2017, the ICBA gave $90,000 to the BC Liberals last year and none to the NDP. So it's almost like they want the party that is probably most at risk of fracturing under any other system to keep having a chance at governing. Or at least they want to support the party that's taken a very strong pro first past the post system. But it's also interesting to see these kind of videos still come out before the July 1st window closes on third parties to do whatever they want, after which they have to start registering, etc.
The video did also include a clip from Andrew Weaver in it, which admittedly does not look great for him, because he basically says, oh yeah, no, this will kill any chance the Liberals will win a majority again, which it's never a good look when you're arguing for a system because it will disadvantage your political opponents.
I mean, technically, the BC Greens will probably never get a majority under the system, but yeah, you're right that it's, you know,
it's
one of those
bad luck.
Yeah, one of those things said in like the party meeting when you're a little too glib. But yeah, Weaver's always been known for his loose lips, let's say, and frankness. And I think there is a certain element to the proportional representation supporters who do like the idea that it seems like the system that will, you know, disadvantage the BC Liberal coalition.
That sentiment is definitely out there. You're just not supposed to say it if you're running in favor of the pro-PR.
For
sure. And it's also kind of a BS thing too, because under the 2001 election, if we were running on any of the systems proposed, the Liberals would have gotten an outright majority. And in fact, if you take that and apply it federally, which is where it's usually directed against the Conservatives, in the post-war period, the only two outright majorities would have been Conservative majorities. So it's one of those things that, you know, it's a nice soundbite, but that isn't actually true.
Yeah. And honestly, for me, it's in the same vein as what we were talking about with what about the effects of the money laundering on the economy. Like, they can still have the right thing to do, I think, to make a fairer system, in my view, is to go to PR, not because it makes the NDP stronger. It probably doesn't. Right now, I think they're floating. They'd lose a few seats, and in most cases, they'd float around. They are surprisingly efficient at getting a proportionate result, except 2001 and 96, where they overperformed. So it's less for me about who had advantages and disadvantages and more about just representing the will of the people. Call me naive and idealistic.
You're naive and not idealistic.
But we'll have more to talk about on proportional representation over the coming weeks. We're hopefully going to be talking very soon to the creator of the dual member proportional system, Sean Graham out of Alberta. We'll find someone to talk about rural urban PR. I think Fair Vote Canada is largely behind that. MMP is more known, but I don't know. Maybe we can get...
Listen to our third episode ever when we talked about it.
Maybe don't. But
it's probably a little rough, but we'll throw a link into the show notes.
Yeah. And if you have someone who wants to defend first past the post and make the compelling case for that, let us know and we'll bring them on. Well, moving on to quick takes, the BC government continues to keep doing things despite it moving into summer. They have announced a bunch of new rules to rein in payday lenders. Those, here's $10,000, all you need is to promise that you'll pay like 20% back a day.
I don't think they usually lend in that range, but usually it's...
There's one over here on Broadway that brags about giving up to 10 grand.
Oh, okay.
These things are unscrupulous.
I was not aware of that location. But yeah, you've seen them around there, the, you know, Cash Money, Money Mart, all of these ones. And yeah, they short-term loans, high interest, like that's basically their entire business model. And the provinces put in some new requirements, such as capping the fees to cash a social assistance or disability check at $2 plus 1% of the value of the check, up to 10 bucks. In addition, they've put some limits on what the payday lenders can request from the borrower in terms of disclosure of personal information, as well as clarifying some of the rules around reporting timelines to Consumer Protection BC.
Like, the big top line change is they're lowering the effective interest rate on a $100 loan from 17% to 15%, which is just trying to give some money back to the most marginalized. Like you said, people are cashing their social assistance and disability checks at these places.
That's something that doesn't get as much attention as the loans, but it's actually one of the main services they provide is check cashing.
I've seen this controversy come around in a lot of places, and these, you know, stores, fronts pop up in low-income neighborhoods. They try to, a lot of times, they're just exploitative attempts to just peel money off the people who have the least, which, yeah, I think, if anything, these changes could go a lot farther. Let's just ban them and, like, open postal banking or something.
Yeah, so, like, they're scummy. Like, that's not really in dispute, but I think you do need that replacement in place because they do provide a service, albeit a very expensive one, in terms of providing some short-term liquidity to people who need it badly. And if you don't actually have a replacement in place, just banning them might actually be a worse-off outcome than letting them continue under the current model.
Tightening the rules for now is a good option, especially since the provincial government doesn't have the option to put in postal banking. Maybe we could be really ambitious and create some kind of Bank of BC. But now I'm just going communist. The other thing that's super scummy are doctors that get a whole bunch of money from pharmaceutical companies and then tell their patients that they should take that drug. And BC is now going to make that a little less, let's say, behind the doctor's door. They're considering some new transparency rules around funding for doctors. So BC is looking at following what Ontario has done recently and basically require pharmaceutical companies to show how much money they've given to different physicians, to different patient groups and other healthcare organizations. There's going to be consultations over the next couple months in Vancouver and Victoria on this broad health sector transparency program. And this is a way to help basically shed some light on what's going on. It's not going to ban anything, as far as I can tell, unless I guess the consultations go really poorly for the doctors, but it will consider things like showing what physicians get paid to give a speech or sit on a board or go to a conference, because a lot of money goes in from pharmaceutical companies to just try to influence and get doctors feeling good about different pharmaceutical medications. The other side of it is these patient groups, which a lot of the time do a lot of good work, but some can seem more like fronts for drug companies, especially when they're just getting tons and tons of money from Pfizer or whoever. And just putting some sunshine on those will hopefully at least reduce the influence of those drug companies on what people are taking.
Yeah, it seems like a fairly good idea, no brainer, just add a little transparency to system requirements. So moving into international news, there's a rather bizarre government contract out in Saudi Arabia, specifically to build a moat around Qatar. So for those of you whose Mideast geography is a little fuzzy, Qatar is this little peninsula that juts out from Saudi Arabia, and they've apparently been having some disputes between the two countries, and Saudi Arabia's decided to go ahead and build a moat and make Qatar an island.
This is the Bugs Bunny approach to world diplomacy. They'll like pull the saw out and cut the map so that, like, something floats away.
Yeah, it's basically that. They're taking Looney Tunes as an instruction manual.
There's nothing, I guess, illegal about this.
Especially if it's on the Saudi Arabia side. It's just like amusing and highly passive aggressive, which, I mean, is better than how aggressive the alternative is. But like, it's just like this weird little bizarre story that I found this week.
Do we know what the actual, like, just on broad senses, what the dispute between Qatar and Saudi Arabia is? Or is it just, you know, local politics, as it were?
Supporting terrorism and meddling in their affairs.
Like, I could see the argument for this policy, even though I wouldn't agree with it, if there was like a massive refugee crisis coming from one country or the other. But both are relatively affluent for the region and aren't letting people get out of their country. And so there's no like physical need for a barrier. So this one's just like out of spite.
Yeah. And, you know, Saudi Arabia's accused Qatar of supporting terrorism and meddling in the affairs. So, like, legitimate grievances there, but like, it just seems a weird way to approach it. And especially at the cost of over $750 million. Like, they spent close to $1 billion to do this.
That actually doesn't seem like that bad.
Yeah.
Like, that's cheaper than some bridges around here, which Qatar would have to pay for, I'm sure.
I think it has to do with the prevailing labor rates over there.
Right. I mean, it is a make work program.
That is true.
Jobs.
Speaking of dumb borders, we're going to finish off with a somewhat lighthearted follow-up to the Trudeau case. The beer may not be free, but Gerald Trudeau's at least getting a beer named after him. So there's a pair of breweries in Ottawa and Gatineau, which straddle the Quebec-Ontario border, and they've decided to team up to brew this beer that's kind of a product of both provinces, so to kind of get around some of the rules, and they've symbolically named it after Como.
I like this idea, although knowing what Como drank and what he was shipping across the border illegally, apparently, I worry that this collaboration is going to be a lager that tastes like piss.
So apparently it's not going to be that. Although it's a very dry IPA, so it's, you know, not the greatest anyway, but like, it's better than what Como was drinking.
I'll give a shout out if they're listening, Boys in Short Pants or Michael Spratt, either of you three. Get this beer when it's out and give us a beer review. Let Canadians know whether Como's beer should exist and should we tear down these trade barriers.
The answer to the second one's obviously yes, but yes, do let us know how the beer is. And that has been Politikos. Find links to stories we mentioned in the show notes at politikos.ca. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politikos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.